on this edition for Saturday, September 7th. Hurricane Dorian's aftermath, devastation and destruction in the Bahamas. Flooding and thousands without power along the Carolina coast. And in our signature segment, Rwanda, a model of success, but at what cost? Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Hari Srinivasan.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. Hurricane Dorian continued to travel north today, re-strengthening to a Category 2 and threatening to bring storm surge impacts to Nova Scotia, southwestern Newfoundland, and Prince Edward Island. Tens of thousands of people lost power as Dorian approached the region this afternoon. The hurricane's destructive path began in the Bahamas, where it first made landfall as a Category 5 hurricane, leaving some of the northern islands almost totally destroyed. Hundreds of people waited for ferries to evacuate them from Abaco Island to Nassau.
My immediate family began to mourn, right? I haven't heard from them since the hurricane, and they haven't heard from me, so I don't know how they're situated, and they definitely don't know how I am situated. Right now, they're not sure if I'm living or dead.
A privately owned cruise ship that took aid workers to the Bahamas on Thursday returned today, bringing more than 1,500 evacuees to the port of Palm Beach. The U.S. Coast Guard sent crews to the Bahamas to assist and, as of this morning, had rescued 290 people in the area. Janelle Eli is with the Hurricane Dorian operation for the American Red Cross. She joins us now from Nassau, Bahamas. How significant is the devastation that has happened there?
The devastation here is massive, and honestly, it's heartbreaking. I was on the island of Abaco, and there were so many houses without roofs and other houses that were just completely demolished. Even when landing in the airport I landed, you could see trees uprooted and snapped in half. People are really telling some horrific stories about the damage.
And have most of the people managed to get off? Are they on the other islands like Nassau?
So there are a lot of people who have managed to get off, whether by boat or helicopter or plane, but there definitely are more people still there and in need of assistance.
Right. Well, what are the most immediate needs besides shelter, if they have places to go and if there are government shelters? But, I mean, water, electricity, I mean, it sounds like there is no infrastructure left.
Certainly on the islands, water, food, electricity, medical care, and emergency shelter are huge needs. There are a lot of people still sleeping on the streets. There are people in need of clean water and sanitation. We've seen in disasters before that if clean water isn't addressed within, you know, the first days and weeks, it could cause secondary humanitarian needs. So that's absolutely a priority. At the Red Cross, we're also focusing on something else, which is helping reconnect families. Even people who've lost their homes, lost their livelihoods, lost all their physical property, if they haven't been able to get in touch with their loved ones, their family members, if they're not sure whether they're safe and alive, they really don't have peace of mind. So that is top of mind for lots of people affected by this disaster. And at the Red Cross, we're really hoping in the days and weeks ahead to focus on that.
So are you creating essentially the equivalent of a virtual pinup board where people can say, here I am, has anybody heard from so-and-so?
That's a great way to put it. We have a program called Restoring Family Links, and we open up cases of people who haven't heard from their loved ones and family members during disasters or other crises, and we're able to help trace whether those people are alive, safe, maybe where they are.
And what's the easiest thing that someone from mainland United States can do right now?
So right now, to help people affected by Hurricane Dorian in both the U.S. and the Bahamas, we're asking people to go to redcross.org and donate. But another thing people can do is just take this moment to remember that disasters can happen anytime. Big disasters can affect anyone. And this is a good time to take stock of your own evacuation plan, of your own emergency plan. How will your family react? What will you bring with you? Even first aid classes. These are things we recommend so that people are really ready for disasters when they strike.
You've seen a lot of different disaster zones. Is it going to be possible for a place like Abaco Island to recover from this?
The heartbreak families are facing, that's not something that people easily recover from. And that will take a long time. But so will the physical needs. Right now, we're really focused on urgent needs. But in the future, people certainly will need to have their livelihoods restored. People lost their fishing boats, their bicycles, the stock in their stores. And so those are things that humanitarian agencies will also want to focus on as we move forward.
All right, Janelle Eli from the Hurricane Dorian operation for the American Red Cross joining us via Skype from the Nassau Bahamas today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
After hitting the Bahamas, Hurricane Dorian made landfall again on the coast of North Carolina. Storm surge and winds damaged homes and caused power outages on islands and along the coast. But the state director of emergency management told me this afternoon that the damage was less than first forecast.
The storm just a few days ago looked like it was going to be very bad, but again, it wasn't as bad as we anticipated. Although I will tell you that we did experience some tornadic activity. And we're currently executing some relief and response operations on Ocracoke Island on the Outer Banks in Hyde County.
Reuters reporter Amanda Becker is on the coast at Nags Head, North Carolina, and she has more on what residents there faced during the storm. Amanda, it looks like a kind of a gorgeous day on the beach.
People are returning to a beautiful day today. They started letting permanent residents and critical business owners and personnel back in at noon. And they are returning to actually what is a perfect beach day. Some strong waves, but other than that, it's gorgeous here.
Yeah, you can see some of the, how far and how high did the sea get during the storm? I'm assuming you couldn't be standing where you are now.
Yes, actually yesterday afternoon when I was here, a few hours after the hurricane cleared out, was all the way up to the dunes. There was really no beach left. So they're starting, and I'll turn a little bit. You can start to see they are regaining their beach. It's kind of almost back to where it was 2 days ago before the storm.
And what kind of damage did the people there in Nags Head or along the Outer Banks experience?
So I've only been able to get to the northern Outer Banks because the road is still closed south of Nags Head past the National Seashore. There's another bridge. Anytime there's a severe storm here, it gets really hard to get to Cape Hatteras, Ocracoke Island, of course, which has been on the news. Frisco, areas like that, basically sand. It's a very narrow part of the Outer Banks. And on either side of Route 12, you have the ocean on one side with a very small dune and a marsh on the other side, kind of on the sound side. So anytime there's any sort of rainfall at all, that tends to wash out. It tends to wash a lot of sand over there. So it could be a couple more days before residents of the South Outer Banks are able to get in and out again. But in the areas of the northern Outer Banks, people are able to return starting today.
All right. So these are people who are familiar with living along the coast. Did most of the people there evacuate when they were told to?
No. So it's a very orderly procedure here. Kind of most of the houses right along the beach are rentals. People own them and rent them out to vacationers. The vacationers were the first to go. For liability reasons, the rental companies don't allow them to stay here. They were gone. So when I was here, I guess it was Thursday afternoon ahead of the storm, Thursday during the day, you know, it seemed very quiet. A lot of businesses were closed. Grocery stores were closed. The local Publix was being used kind of as a staging area to feed first responders. But all the permanent residents told me they were staying put. A lot of them have houses that are not right on the beach, either as their primary residence or a secondary residence. So they were going to those houses, but they were not leaving the area. And one of the reasons why is you can't get here except for a few bridges. And once they're closed, you know, they've complained that in the past it delays insurance estimates because they can't get back mm-hmm. into their houses.
And what kind of sort of a government response do you see out there? Are there any emergency vehicles? Are there any kind of support services that have made their way out to the places that you've been to?
So the places I've been to have sustained virtually no damage. On the sound side of the Outer Banks, kind of the facing inland, there's actually been more damage because there's more trees over there. There are more things to fall down in the wind. So you see a lot of utility trucks out today, the North Carolina Department of Transportation clearing debris, things like that, looking at power lines, fixing utility poles, people cutting trees that have fallen. But even the houses right along the ocean, I've spent today and actually yesterday, right after the storm came through, right along the beach road. And, you know, people put up their storm shutters, and other than some, you know, broken fences and things like that, the houses here are all okay.
All right, Amanda Becker of Reuters joining us from Nags Head via FaceTime. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For the latest on Hurricane Dorian's path and the damage left in its wake, visit pbs.org/newshour. Iran stepped up uranium enrichment today, activating a chain of advanced centrifuges in defiance of the 2015 nuclear agreement. At a news conference, a spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Organization said this could be reversed if European nations compensated Tehran for all the money it's lost since President Trump withdrew from the deal and reimposed sanctions last year. The 2015 agreement curbed Iran's nuclear activities in exchange for economic sanctions relief. Dueling marches collided in London's Parliament Square today. One side in favor and the other side against the UK leaving the European Union without a deal. Members of the pro-Brexit Democratic Football Lads Alliance clashed with the anti-Brexit group March for Change. European Union flags waved. Besides a flying beer can, police managed to keep the two groups apart. The UK's departure from the EU under a no-deal Brexit is still set for October 31st, but debate continues in Parliament. Russia and Ukraine freed prisoners today in an exchange that Ukraine's president called the first step to stop the fighting in eastern Ukraine that has killed more than 13,000 people since 2014. Planes took off from Moscow and Kiev at almost the same time today, carrying 35 prisoners each. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed home 24 Ukrainian sailors Russia captured last year, along with 11 other prisoners. The freed Russian prisoners included a journalist accused of treason and a suspect in the downing of a Malaysia Airlines flight over eastern Ukraine in 2014 that killed 298 people. India's space agency announced today that it lost contact with its Vikram lunar lander, and the fate of the lander is presently unknown. The craft was making its final approach to the moon's surface to deploy a rover at the unexplored lunar south pole. India's space agency said that the lander's operations were normal until it was just over 1 mile above the surface. The landing would have made India only the fourth country to successfully land on the moon. Hundreds gathered last night to mourn the 34 victims of Monday's diving boat fire off the coast of Southern California. 34 scuba tanks lined the stage, and those attending placed white carnations in baskets. The diving boat Conception sank off the coast of Santa Cruz Island in 65 feet of water before dawn on Monday. Investigators say flames may have prevented some of the victims trapped in a bunk room below deck from reaching a stairway and escape hatch. Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe died this week. He ruled that country for almost 40 years. He helped the nation gain independence, but was later reviled for his brutal crackdowns on opponents and a failing economy. For some, the story is a similar one to that of Rwanda, where a quarter century ago, more than 800,000 Tutsi and moderate Hutus were killed in a genocide that lasted 100 days. Current President Paul Kagame, leader of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, has been celebrated by many as an ingenious leader. But to his opponents and even some of his formerly close associates, his authoritarian rule is setting a dangerous precedent. Special correspondents Benedict Moran and Jorgen Samso report.
Jean Bosco Ngarama left Rwanda 7 years ago, but the memories of his torture there are still fresh.
J'ai été placé dans une chambre.
I was brought into a small room, which I considered like a slaughterhouse. I saw machetes, I saw axes, I saw electric cables. It was a room where they torture people.
Ngarama says his problems began in 2010 when he lived in the capital, Kigali. He worked for a human rights organization and was openly critical of Rwanda's government. In March of that year, unknown assailants launched grenade attacks on the city. Soon after, Ngarama was arrested and imprisoned.
They asked me to admit that I know the people who threw the grenades. You have no information? I said no. They said, if you don't do it willingly, you'll do it by force. They slapped me. Then they brought batons and they hit me with electric cables. I was standing up. When I screamed, they took plastic bottles and shoved it in my mouth. Blood was pouring out of my mouth.
He says a soldier then electrocuted him, and he passed out. He was held for 8 months before being charged with conspiracy. Months later, he was tried, but was in fact acquitted. Ngarama now lives in Philadelphia and is determined to speak out.
They knew I was innocent. But sometimes the military soldiers said, Jean Bosco, even if you don't do anything, we want to brainwash you. That's the term they use, to wash your brain.
Allegations like Ngarama's tell a tale about Rwanda at odds with the international reputation it has worked hard to achieve. The East African country is known for making a remarkable turnaround since the 1994 genocide. Today, it has one of the fastest growing economies in Africa. There's universal healthcare. The streets are clean. These results have earned the country and President Paul Kagame praise in the United States.
It's an honor to have you as a friend. Thank you.
Paul Kagame is the reason Rwanda is leading the way. Rwanda is a clear example of what a strong strategic partner should look like to the United States.
Last year, President Kagame was named African of the Year at the All Africa Business Leaders Awards for his role in the transformation of his country.
This is the Kigali Convention Center, built for an estimated $200 to $300 million. This week, they're hosting the Africa CEO Forum, which is labeled Africa's biggest annual business summit.
It's an example of how the country has branded itself a hub of business and tourism through companies like Rwandair, the national airlines.
Rwandair today covers about 26 destinations, and we are looking to opening more new routes very soon.
The goal is to seek investment and prosperity by portraying what is safe and business-friendly about the country. European Union Ambassador to Rwanda, Nicola Bellomo.
Rwanda is now on the map. Rwanda is on the radar screen everywhere. President Kagame is becoming more and more the voice of Africa. Some consider his development model, something to be followed.
Despite praise from the United States, the 2018 U.S. State Department's own human rights report on Kagame's Rwanda cites instances of unlawful or arbitrary killings, forced disappearances, torture, and arbitrary detention of Rwandan civilians by state security forces. Journalists have been threatened by police or killed under mysterious circumstances. Most at risk are those who directly oppose the government. In 2010, opposition leader Victoire Ingabire was running for president when she was charged with, quote, minimizing the genocide and so-called divisionism, which is a crime in Rwanda. She was convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison. She is now out of prison after Kagame approved her early release in September of last year.
It is not easy to be in opposition in Rwanda.
In her office hang the pictures of 9 party members who are in jail, plus one who mysteriously disappeared while in prison last October.
The government has a characteristic of a facto one-party system. We have so many political parties in the country, but they work together as one party.
Even some of Kagame's closest advisors have fallen out with him. David Himbara worked for President Kagame as an economic advisor and then as his private secretary.
He's one-man government. No, he's in charge of the executive, the judiciary, and the legislative branch.
Himbara says many of the original men and women who came to power with Paul Kagame after the genocide have fled, or worse.
They're either dead or in exile. Nobody, no original person, they're nowhere to be seen. The others are underground. They're keeping quiet. Kagame is a person whose life is consumed by militarism and violence.
Himbara now lives in Toronto, Canada, and advocates for Rwandan opposition groups. Even those Rwandans who have left the country aren't guaranteed safety. In 2008, former Rwandan spy chief Patrick Karegeya fled to South Africa and set up an opposition party in exile. He was found strangled to death in a Johannesburg hotel in 2014. This May, a South African police officer investigating the crime testified that the murder was directly linked to the involvement of the Rwandan government. Kagame denied any involvement in the attack, but 2 weeks after Karegeya was assassinated, he issued this warning.
Betrayal has consequences. Anyone who betrays our cause or wishes to harm our people will fall a victim. What remains to be seen is how you fall victim.
There are many ways.
Meanwhile, the man who represented Rwanda at the United Nations as recently as 2016, Richard Gasana, has sought asylum in the United States. His lawyer confirmed that Ambassador Gasana fell out with Kagame and fled to the U.S. for reasons that, quote, relate to his personal safety. But in a country recently ripped apart by ethnic divisions, Kagame's supporters say his strong-arm approach is necessary to create national unity and so avoid another bloody conflict. Jean-Paul Kimonyo is a policy advisor to President Kagame.
Now we are trying to get back to this state of a strong nation. Without social cohesion and without national unity, there's not much you can do. You cannot mobilize the population to go ahead and transform things and be efficient.
Rwanda projects continued economic growth, which it hopes will bring it into the ranks of high-income countries by 2050. Kimonyo says these lofty aspirations require a strong leader at the helm.
What we want is a profound change, and profound change takes time. It's not the time of the journalist, it's not the time of the researcher or observers. It's our time. Yeah. And our time is to change things profoundly.
It is difficult to judge how much support there is inside the country for Kagame's brand of profound change. In 2015, Rwandan voters approved a change to the national constitution, allowing Kagame to run for a third term and possibly stay in office until 2034. And he was re-elected in 2017 with a staggering 98.8% of the vote. Advocates like Human Rights Watch said the vote took place in a context of, quote, limited free speech or open political space, and the U.S. State Department said it was marked by irregularities. At the African CEO gathering, Kagame addressed his critics overseas, saying he works at the behest of the Rwandan people.
You have openly stated that it doesn't matter anybody from outside, whether you like me or you don't like me. The President Kagame is here as the president of Rwanda, as a business of Rwandans. It's their business. If they want Kagame, they will have him. If they don't want him, they remove him. Doesn't matter whether...
This weekend, a remarkable art project opens in Austria, not in a museum, but in a soccer stadium that's typically home to the Austrian football second league team. In this temporary art intervention called Verforest, the unending attraction of nature, spectators will see trees in a setting designed to both inspire and warn future generations about the value of nature. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker has the story.
In southern Austria, artist Klaus Littmann has transformed the field of a 30,000-seat stadium into a forest.
It goes back to the drawing which we project here by Max Peitner, who in 1970 had the vision that one day it could happen that we look at nature in designated areas only. What we have been doing for decades at zoos with endangered animals could happen to nature.
Spectators will observe the forest as it stands silently on the field, while the local team plays at another stadium in the area for a few weeks. Littmann says his living art installation is designed to challenge viewers to consider the consequences of climate change.
For some, this will be a highly symbolic character, or of a philosophical character, like the tree of life or the place of longing. Others with an affinity for art might actually see a sculpture or an installation. And for many, because of the current situation, this represents a memorial as part of the climate change.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend,
the 300 Saturday. The trees will be replanted nearby after the temporary exhibit closes in late October, preserving the stadium forest as a forest sculpture.
If people ask me, when is this project successful? I always give the same response. It's successful if this picture goes around the world, and more importantly, if it stays in people's minds.
Finally tonight, among the many things damaged or destroyed by Hurricane Dorian was the North Campus of the University of the Bahamas. But college students there may have a new opportunity to continue their education. Hampton University in Virginia says it will provide free room and board and tuition for the current semester for students from that school. So far, 22 have expressed interest in the offer. And this isn't the first time Hampton University has helped displaced students. It did the same for college students in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.